Today on the Neil Wilkins podcast, I'm joined by Ben Gutman, who is the author of Simply Put. Now, this is a book that I will advocate from the rooftops because this one is so, so important and really, really a topic very close to my heart because as a marketer of many, many decades, one of the things I've always tussled with and not always got quite right and probably still fail to do so is the idea of communicating simply. And I think as marketers, business owners, entrepreneurs, we're so passionate about what we do. We have so many things to say, and often this doesn't serve us. So welcome to the show, Ben. I'm hoping you're going to be able to clarify how to make things simple.
Thanks for having me, Neil. It's great to be here.
So let's kind of begin at the beginning. Why is it so hard for people to not keep it simple?
Well, you hit a good point there in the intro, which is that the advice of keeping stuff simple is something that is not particularly revolutionary, right? Like, you've heard that a million times. We've seen it in a million books before. But what I was curious about really was, what is the mechanism through which that works? And then how do we dissect that and produce output, if that's email or an ad campaign or a proposal, whatever it is, that is simple? And what really happens when I look into simplicity is I came across this idea of fluency. And so the word fluent is something that we know in our like day-to-day life, right? Like, you can be fluent in English or Spanish or Mandarin. Where we're fluent, things are easy, right? Things flow. That's the Latin root of the word fluency. It's actually the word flowing. But when you ask a cognitive scientist about the word fluency, well, that describes something a little bit different, which is, how easy is it for you to take something from out in the world, stick it in your head, and make sense of it? Right? How easy is it for you to kind of read something, hear something, process it, and make use of that information? The easier something is, the more fluent something is, if it doesn't take that much work, if it kind of flows in, well, turns out that's associated with all the things that we often want in communication. We want something that's more fluent is more trusted, is more liked, is more likely to be bought, all the things that we're often trying for. And the inverse is also true, which is that things that are more complicated, things that take a lot of work, that take a lot of sweat, mental cycles to understand and to make use of, well, we don't like it, we don't trust it, we don't buy it, all the things that we don't want. So when we're looking at why it's so hard, well, we have this kind of gap because we want to be fluent as a receiver of communication. We want things to be fluent. But when we're a sender of communication, we're often pulled in the opposite direction. The incentives align against that. We are pulled internally by things like an additive bias that are kind of yanking us that way. We're more likely to add than subtract. And then externally, well, we're incentivized by having more lines in our resume or things in the news or the boss that wants more of this and people want credit for that. All these other forces also pull us in that direction. That's the core problem, is this gulf between where we want to receive communication, which is fluent and simple, and where we're really built and incentivized currently to create communication, which is something that's complicated and further away.
I love the science behind this. This is already kind of really resonating with me because, as you say, there's kind of nothing new in the debate, but there is so much new in the way that we're kind of translating, I guess, the application of what we know to be the right thing, which is to keep things simple. And I'm loving this kind of two-way, I guess, flow of information between sender and receiver, because I think for a lot of us as marketers, we're almost obsessed with the sending. It's almost like, I've got these messages, I've got this stuff I need to put out. And yeah, you know, we're customer centric, you know, we listen to our customers, and then we kind of forget about that bit. Mm-hmm. And then we just send out. So even though we kind of believe, and we're probably kidding ourselves, we believe that we're trying to get into a conversation, it's more often than not a monologue. And I think that's where a lot of us get a little bit stuck. And I'm looking in the mirror here. I'm not saying that I'm absolutely perfect at this, you know, far from it. I know the theory. I know what I should be doing. But often it is, I've got this thing to say, so I'm just going to say it. Mm-hmm. Are we kind of, by doing that, are we kind of forgetting the idea that even though the message might actually be received at the recipient's end. So they actually hear what they're hearing, and it is what potentially, or somewhere close to what we're saying, but it's not being recalled. They couldn't kind of repeat it. They couldn't really act on it because it's not necessarily being understood. Is there kind of a breakdown after it's been received? Because it would make so much obvious sense that if I see something in social media, or it might be a sales call or something like that, so all different content styles,
yeah,
I can get the message across. It goes into the other person's ears or into their eyes, but it's what happens then that I think can often be the downfall of it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the stuff that hits our ears and hits our eyes, we just throw it right out. So, but by some estimates, we are processing something along the lines, or taking in rather, about 11 million bits of information every second through, you know, our eyes, our ears, our touch, smell, taste. But our conscious brain only has the bandwidth to attend to about kind of 0.0004%, an infinitesimally small amount of it that we're able to attend to. And this is something we've known for a long time, and it makes sense from kind of an evolutionary perspective, right? Where oftentimes what we're going to do, if we're you know, you think back to our great 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 ancestors, and they're, you know, kind of wandering around in the savannah, and they see a twig rustling somewhere. Well, quickly you'll jump to the attention to maybe process it, but then you immediately toss it away if it's something that's not important. If it's not something that's trying to eat you or something you can eat, for the most part, we dispose of that. Our lives are really only what we pay attention to. And we are bombarded by lots and lots of things to pay attention to these days. The average American spends about 13 hours a day consuming some form of media. That's a lot, right? Like that's thousands and thousands of messages that are going to be kind of crossing our attention, and either things that we're seeking out, things like an article that I'm reading or an email that I'm waiting for, or it could be things that are kind of bombarding me, like a banner ad or an Instagram ad or whatever it is. And so we don't pay attention to all of these at the same level at which we pay attention to things that matter to us, because we often will kind of scan them, we'll realize it doesn't matter to us, and then we kind of toss it aside. That's the default behavior for most communication. So we have to understand when we're in a position of communicating, if we're an advertiser or a leader of any type, well, we have to connect it with what matters to our audience. And that's one of the solutions when I looked at, okay, how do we make something simple? I've identified five different design principles that are all science-backed about how we get there. And the first one is beneficial. What does it matter to them? Because that's all we really care about.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I can remember a piece in the book where you talk about the whole kind of features and benefits thing, which, mm-hmm. you know, I think a lot of people, if you're experienced in business, you'll know that, you know, you never talk about the features. We used to do that kind of 20, 30 years ago. It became then all about the benefits of the features. So in other words, actually, what is the sort of the output? I wanted to explore something with you, Ben, because for me, I've been playing with this whole idea within communication and kind of marketing messages for a while now, that actually even the benefits bit isn't necessarily enough. And it kind of builds on your point there, which is really trying to get this attention in a very, very crowded space. And we're not just talking about attention versus competition. We're talking about attention in a very busy day, even for lots of people. So it's not even direct competition. It's just competition with the noise of life. So is there an opportunity here, do you think, for communicators, so the senders of the information, to be not necessarily even talking about the benefits of the features, but actually the outcomes that the person can experience from the benefits? In other words, how is my life going to be different if I do engage with you, or if I do even pay attention, even slightly at this early stage, to your kind of messages and stuff? Do you feel it might be something in there in terms of the outcomes? Because that's really the what's in it for me as the recipient, isn't it?
100%, right? So there's a very appropriately simple question that we can ask when we're interrogating our messaging to see, well, are we talking about features, or are we talking about benefits, or are we talking about kind of the next level down of benefits? And so I'll break those benefits into two different layers. There's the functional benefits. There's the things that change in the material world because of the feature. And then there's the emotional benefits, the things that, why am I better because of that? I think a lot of folks have heard of the features versus benefits piece, right? That is something that's like sales 101. If you've ever worked in sales or marketing, at some point you've heard that people don't buy features, they buy benefits piece. And to that extent, actually, when I talk to my students, I tell them a quote from Theodore Levitt, who's a 20th century Harvard professor. I say, if you remember this quote, if you remember this idea, you're going to be ahead of most other people in marketing. And if you forget everything else from this class or from your whole degree, if you remember this one, you're still going to be in good shape. And so he said, people don't want a quarter inch drill. They want a quarter inch hole. People don't want to buy a quarter inch drill. They want a quarter inch hole. They don't want the thing. They want the thing does for them. But I think if I argue, and if you look at the research about this, it substantiates it, that we don't even really want the hole. We want the pictures in the wall. And we don't even want the pictures in the wall. We want the family memories that we get by walking down the hallway and seeing the pictures up there, or the sense of accomplishment we get because we built to finish this project. Those are the things we want. We don't really want even the first level. And so I think one of the best ways to also visualize this is through another example, which I love to share, which you look at toothpaste. Okay, so well, there's a mint flavor in your toothpaste, right? That's a feature. Features you can experience with your five senses, right? You can smell, hear, touch, taste in the event of the mint toothpaste. These different things, they stay very tangible. And so that's often why we talk about them a lot, is because, oh, I see them and therefore I have to talk about them. But that's not why we buy toothpaste. I don't want mint flavor in my toothpaste. What I really want, well, the question that I have to ask that myself is, so what for the mint toothpaste? Mint flavor, so what? Well, that means I'm going to have fresh breath, right? And that's what you're talking about there when you're talking about that first level benefit, that functional benefit. So that's actually kind of what I want a little bit more than I want the mint flavor. But if you interrogate it again and you throw out the question and you say, well, so what to the mint flavor? You get the fresh breath. You say, so what to the fresh breath? You say, well, actually, what I really want is to have a better date tonight. And that's getting a lot closer to what my actual motivations are. And if you ask it again, if you go a third time down, you say, well, why do I actually want to have a better date tonight? You say, well, so what? Okay, well, maybe I want the love and belonging, you know, need. Maybe I want the physical needs. The physiological needs. And so you look at those things that you've probably, you know, saw in a psychology textbook when you were in school and put away, that kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You look at those buckets of motivations. Well, those are pretty universal. So by asking the question three times, we can get from basically any feature out in the world all the way down to that driving motivation. And then once we get there, we can kind of turn around and start to invest accordingly in our message at each one of those different levels. And that will you know, land you an advertisement or a business proposal or whatever that is going to be much more effective.
So you're saying we've been lazy all these years then, aren't you, Ben? Basically, is what you're saying is, like, we've got this product, we've got this service, and we've just shouted about it. We haven't spent the time and the energy going deeper, and actually, even as communicators, asking on behalf of the person we're trying to communicate with, answering those questions, actually asking the why, go deeper. We've been so lazy. That's how it feels.
Well, you know, I try not to ascribe kind of like fault with it necessarily, but I in terms of saying that someone is you know, lazy, is that right? But I think
I'm looking at myself here though, Ben, yeah, as well. I'm saying, oh, I'll take this one on the chin as well.
I think that we haven't done, in some ways it's true though, we haven't done the work that is our responsibility as someone who has something to say to make sure that it's going to connect with what our audience is. And I mentioned before kind of the fact that these features are very tangible. As you see companies get bigger and older, and the people that are writing that ad copy or doing that sales call, as they're doing that, they're getting further and further away from what the actual needs are that the customers have. And as they do that, the benefits get blurrier and blurrier because they don't see the customer. They don't see what their pain is. They don't see how their lives are better. They don't, but the features remain as visible as ever, right? You still see the extra battery on that drill, right? And you still smell the scent of that, you know, of the new car smell, right? Like you still get these different pieces and you can talk about them. And you look at something like Microsoft Excel as an example I cite in the book. If you look at some of the early advertising for Microsoft Excel, it was phenomenal, right? It was really well-written, snappy copy, and it was talking about all the things that it can make you do that you couldn't do before. And if you go on the website for Microsoft now and you look at, you know, look at the page for Excel, it's all just the features. It's all just like it's available in, you know, Microsoft, you know, 365. All the things that are not the reasons why you do it, they just assume that, oh, well, you know, you're going to know what Excel is. And when you contrast that with something like Airtable, which is a much younger company something where, you know, the people who made it are still very close to the problem they were trying to solve. Well, the folks at Airtable are going to be a lot more vocal about why you're going to use that product to be better. And that's something I think that all of us, you know, could stand to do.
I just want to pick up on that point you mentioned there, getting closer to the problem we're trying to solve. There's something quite intriguing about that does get missed, I think, a lot when I talk to a lot of clients and a lot of the people sort of within the marketing industry. Getting close to the problem I want to solve. There's something nice and really kind of minimalist in there. And I know in the book you talk about minimalism. It's one of the key kind of threads that kind of goes through the whole overall storytelling within the book, which I have to say, people, is simply put, literally simply put. And it's just a really nice way of kind of identifying that this stuff is not complicated, but therein lies one of the biggest challenges is the fact it's not complicated. How does somebody who is just innately of the Excel kind of mindset and says, look, competition over there got 1,000 features on their product or service means we've got to get 1,001. How do you have the confidence, particularly if you're going up against your boss, to say, look, we shouldn't be doing it this way. You know, we should be talking about these wonderful emotive human outcomes that arise as a result of our equivalent of Excel. How do you strip it right the way back to the bare bones of the value that you're bringing? Because that's in itself sounds really simplistic, but it's actually really hard.
Oh yeah. I mean, one of the tools that I talk about a lot in the book, and it's under the chapter for empathy, which is, you know, are you speaking in the language that your audience understands? Right? This is one of the principles about how we get there. Are you meeting both in terms of like the literal language, but are you meeting them where they are in terms of their motivations, their emotions, their experiences? And the real kind of solution for empathy is also kind of obvious, which is you got to talk to your audience. You have to go and you know, call somebody up or track them down on the sidewalk or do a focus group or do even a survey. And you got to talk to people. And you have to make sure that what you're saying is in the language that they're primed to receive it in, that they're understanding what you're doing. It's very easy for us to kind of stay in our own bubbles, for us to stay in our own, you know, worlds of acronyms and jargon and all the stuff that we are so close to, and we understand everything that we mean, that we know. But that's often almost 100% of the time not the case for who we're talking to, right? We're often talking to people who are not in our own bubbles, who do not understand all the same things that we do. And when you look actually at some of the research around this, there's quite a body of studies that will show this idea of the false consensus effect. And so the false consensus effect basically says we're primed to believe that everybody else has kind of the same opinions that we do, and that our opinions and experience are much more representative of the norm than they really are. And they do this with like ice, you know, the example is like an ice cream, right? My favorite flavor of ice cream might be mint chip. And so I might go out and say, well, okay, if I'm a pretty normal guy, I like mint chip. Therefore, I bet you like 75% of people like mint chip, right? That's probably the flavor. But then we look at the studies. Well, maybe 10% of people like mint chip, and most people like chocolate. Some people like vanilla, and that is going to come back, you know, it's completely, completely different than what my estimates are going to be. This happens in politics. This happens in business, where we're much more likely to overstate who we, that are, that the fact that we represent, other people. So you have to get out and you have to talk to people. And they have to represent your audience as much as they can, right? You know, if I'm selling, you know, a product for like house painters, right? I'm selling a product for house painters. It doesn't matter how many accountants I talk to. I could talk to 400 accountants, and they're not going to tell me anything I really need to know about talking to the house, you know, about selling to house painters, right? And vice versa. It doesn't matter. I can speak to one. I can speak to four accountants, and they're going to give you more information about how to sell to accountants than 400 house painters are going to tell me about doing that. So that's not particularly, again, revelatory, but the thing is, we really don't like to do it. We're really bad about going out and doing that type of testing, about that type of interviewing, because it's really uncomfortable, right? Like, if you have to go stand on the street corner and ask people about something, or call up some stranger and ask them about something, you might get, you know, kind of weird looks. You might get answers you don't like. And so we often really don't do it. But when we don't do it, we skip it. We're really the only ones that we're hurting.
If we get answers that we don't like, that's a really interesting one, because it's actually then hard, isn't it? If we get something back that we really don't like, and almost it's to the point where we have to reinvent everything in terms of our proposition and even in terms of our branding, we might get to a point where actually for the target audience that we're aiming for, we are so inappropriate. They either don't get it, they don't understand it, or they literally, and this would be the worst one, is they get it, but they don't want it in the way that we're positioning it. There's going to be some hard truths to face here, aren't there? Particularly if you're properly actively listening.
Absolutely. And that, it goes back to, you know, I would much rather get the bad news doing that, because I'd rather get the bad news in the test, in the interview, than I would getting it later on, because it's, as you go further in any project, even if it's writing an email, even if it is a simple proposal, let alone a giant ad campaign or a big website you're building, whatever it is, if as you go forward, you're closing a bunch of doors behind you, right? And then to open them costs a lot of time and money. If you're building a website, as you're building it, you realize, okay, well, these are, you know, you go from something very fuzzy to something very concrete, right? You have the site map and then the wireframe and then the initial designs and the full things, and then you get to the beta and then eventually get to the thing. If I didn't ask anybody at any point about, are we saying the right things, or am I building the right thing here, and I only do that at the end, well, what happens is I wasted all of this period that's leading up to it. When if I figured out in the beginning that the direction I was heading down was the wrong one, well, that's great. That's excellent news, because now I can find the right direction before I spend all that time and money trying to chase down the wrong one.
So it feels like there's a real process in this whole thing. It feels like it begins with the listening, really kind of deep understanding of, you know, at an emotional level. And I love the way you break down, you know, the kind of the benefits at a functional level, I think you described it as, and then this emotional level. And I think a lot of us, we kind of get the functional level bit, but we're not really, if we're being brutally honest, not really attacking that kind of emotional level. One, because you have to go to those painful points that you're talking about there, and it takes time, and time is money, and this perception that, well, we haven't got time, we need to get this thing to market, and all of those kinds of arguments that come through. But I love the way you've unpicked it there with the whole idea of it's going to cost more if you get it wrong. So it's almost like there's a risk analysis going on here. Yeah, you can try doing it your own way. You can, you know, take your own biases and you can sort of wing it and sort of hope that it's going to work. Or you can take a little bit more time, be a little bit more patient, a little more diligent. The longer term, I'm thinking here, though, the longer term value that you're going to provide to your audience is going to be so much more focused and targeted, though, taking that longer route. Mm-hmm. Do you think a lot of us are rushing it too much?
That's a good question. Are we rushing it too much? I think that it depends on what we're doing, right? You have to invest accordingly in different forms of communication and different arenas, right? I can't spend as much time crafting an email that I have to send 100 of, over the course of a day, as I can working on the kind of homepage copy for, our big new website that's going to get a million visits a month. Because you have to do one all the time, and one you get to kind of spend a lot. And oftentimes those are aligned with what the kind of incentives are, right? Or, we have more time to do the bigger things. We have less time to do the smaller things. I think that keeping the principles in mind about how we do this will make us better even in the times when we have to do things a little bit faster. I understand I can't go out and focus group. I can't go out and ask somebody, for feedback on every single email or text message that I'm sending. But doing a little bit of it at some point can start to help me get out of my own head and get me in a position where I could do a better job kind of just intuitively by it. Or, that's the subtitle of that chapter is Welcoming the Enlightened Idiot, right? Sometimes, and the enlightened idiot is everybody, right? I'm an enlightened idiot. Idiot means the common man. If you look back at the origins of that word, and you want somebody who's the outsider, who's the common man, who is your audience, who understands things that you don't, to be there to kind of interrogate you for this thing. Sometimes, if you're hiring an agency, you're hiring an outside provider for something, it's better to get somebody that's in a different field or that has specialties in different areas, because they're able to be that enlightened idiot and say, what the hell are you talking about? What is this jargon that you're using here? What is this acronym that's being thrown around? Because maybe the people who are saying it understands it, but does your audience always get it?
I have to ask you the question, AI, how is that factoring into this? Because it feels like if we're looking to do a lot more attention, and there is almost this need to spend more time crafting the right things to make things simple, so we can almost reverse engineer to learn ourselves how better to do this. So next time we do it, it actually feels a little bit easier. It sounds to me like there is a part for AI to play in all of this, because a lot of the stuff you've talked about here, Ben, it is going to take us time. So can we use AI to kind of fast track it?
So I have a not very simple, but relatively pretty nuanced take on the AI stuff right now. A few different things, no particular order. Number one is that marketing is probably the industry that AI is at this moment most useful for. I would say, and marketing broadly in terms of like social media content and email content and blog posts and websites and all the, we used to joke when I ran my agency that there was the great man-eating content monster, right? This is the internet of 2010, 2020, and we'll see, it'll be in 2030, that everything demands more content, right? Your blog needs content, your newsletter needs content, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, everything needs more content, and you kind of just have to keep feeding the beast, right? So marketing successfully in that environment is often about how do you say the same thing 100 times and in a way that's still engaging to your audience, so without you getting tired of it, without the audience getting tired of it, and it still provides value everywhere. AI, as it's currently built, something like ChatGPT, is really good at that. Like that's actually one of the best things. It is. If you say, hey, listen, I need to make 500 descriptions of like a t-shirt, right? It can generate you 500 paragraphs that are going to be a little bit different each way for a t-shirt. And it will be really helpful in doing that at a scale which you can't do it if you as an individual copywriter. So marketing is an area right now where it's really useful. There's a lot of places where people are trying to apply it where it's not so useful, like writing novels and screenplays and those type of things, where it's not really providing any and any sort of semblance of replacement of the human piece of it. So that's one piece, is that marketing is a really useful tool for it. Second component of that is that the principles in this book about simplicity, I do think translate in many ways to being able to use this to inform an AI to improve something. AI is, as it currently is right now, is really good at improving things. And it's really good a little bit of the kind of, I want to just generate 100, you know, names for something. Like, it's good at those type of things. It's not so good at kind of writing something from whole cloth. But if you say, hey, I have this one paragraph here, it feels a little clunky. Can you please make it beneficial, focused, salient, empathetic, minimal, all the different principles? It will kind of get you there a little bit. And I have a friend who runs a company and he has a podcast who went out and did this exact experiment. He took my book, he took the principles in it, and he went to, it built a kind of custom GPT and said, okay, can you improve my email copy, you know, based off of this, you know, framework here? And the results were kind of a 40% improvement that he had in his click-through rate because of the email copy that was simply put versus the one that wasn't otherwise. And not to kind of, you know, drag on too long, but the last piece of the puzzle for the AI component is in the classroom when I teach. My students are college seniors. They are marketing majors. I tell them, by all means, this is a tool. Go ahead and use it. Use it responsibly. If you don't use it responsibly, it's often pretty obvious and, you know, you'll get penalized for it. However, the cat's out of the bag on this one, right? You're not closing Pandora's box and this tool's not going to stop existing. However, I would be much more concerned if I was like an eighth grade English teacher and I had to teach people how to like write for the first time. And instead of them being able to do that, they just rely on the, you know, the kind of calculator for words that is ChatGPT, and they get something out there. That I'd be more concerned about. But in the professional like marketing context, I think generally it's a neutral, if not maybe even slightly positive thing right now.
That's really, really helpful. Thank you for sort of putting that context in there, because I just felt, you know, having read the book, I thought there needs to be almost like an equation that links the two. And I think with those three points there, Ben, you've absolutely nailed it there. That's great. This has been such a really useful conversation for me. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I'm really going to take away from this is that differentiation between, you know, functional benefits and emotional benefits, because I think for a lot of people, they've just thought of benefits as being this one thing. So I think for me, and I'm sure a lot of others, you've really clarified there's a fundamental difference between the two. And if we spend that little bit of extra time, you know, going that little bit deeper, then there's a huge, huge lot more value then that we can be providing to whoever the audience is. And I think this applies to B2B, B2C, anybody who's communicating, as you said right at the outset, it's not just marketers. This is for anybody who's communicating in any kind of form of human-to-human interaction, really. So I want to point people in the direction of the book, because people need to get a copy of this, Ben. So should they come to your website?
Yeah, absolutely. And Neil, thank you so much. If you want to learn more, go check out my book. It's called Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them by Ben Gutman. And so I'm Ben Gutman. If you go on Amazon, you search for that, you'll find it, Barnes & Noble, or bengutman.com, bengutman.com. It's not a great name for radio. There's two T's and two N's. You need both of them. But if you go there, you can find the book wherever it's sold. You can download a free chapter. The first chapter is free. If you want to go grab that, sign up for my email list. I send an email every Tuesday. And if you want to get in touch, shoot me an email, connect on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from you and, you know, see how this could be of help.
Wonderful, Ben. And I shall continue to point people in your direction when they say, I'm not really sure about this whole content thing. We're not getting much impact from our emails, or we need to design a new website. How do we start? I say, well, Ben's got a book all about that. So I should be putting people in your direction. Thank you so much for your time today, Ben.
Thanks, Neil. This was a lot of fun.